Today, we're diving deep into the role of your gut in health and disease, particularly looking through the lens of Parkinson's disease. For most of history, Parkinson's disease was actually a rare disorder. In 1817, a 62-year-old British physician, Dr. James Parkinson, wrote a case series about six individuals who developed a distressing disease which he said, quote, had not yet obtained a place in the classification. In 1855, 40 years later, after he first described the condition, just 22 people out of the 15 million people in England and Wales had died of the condition. But fast forward to today. According to the Global Burden of Disease study, neurological disorders are currently the leading source of disability around the world. And the fastest growing of these disorders is Parkinson's disease. From 1990 to 2015, the number of individuals with Parkinson's disease globally increased 118%. Our guest today is Martha Carlin. She's a citizen scientist, a systems thinker, and the founder of BioCollective, a microbiome company that's at the frontier of our understanding of gut health, the microbiome, and disease. When her husband John was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2002, she dove into the existing research to find a way to help him. And when she came across a newly discovered research showing the link between gut bacteria and two phenotypes of Parkinson's, she quit her job in New York as a business turnaround expert and dove into how to turn around the human body instead, particularly looking into our gut health and microbiome. Her background in systems thinking has sparked collaborations across the scientific spectrum, including neuroscience and engineering and infectious disease, and this in turn has created out-of-the-box thinking on how to bring new perspectives to disease, our gut health, and microbiome. And it's why we're so excited to have her as our guest on the podcast today. Are you ready to change your tomorrow and start feeling good again? You're in the right place. Grab your coffee and together, let's start doing wellness differently. I'm Heather Young, a certified personal trainer.
And I'm Jennifer Klutz, a registered dietitian nutritionist. Join us for conversations that will inspire you to ask better questions, remove the overwhelm, and discover what you can do to change your health now.
Welcome to the Critical Conversations Podcast. Martha, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today. And what great background research you did before the interview.
Well, we did do background research, and I'll say we found so many wonderful things about you. But the thing that stood out the most to me was you're not a scientist by, you know, schooling. It's not what you jumped into. But I would say with the research your company is doing and all the scientific breakthroughs that it's accomplishing, you've definitely become a citizen scientist. And I had never heard the term citizen scientist until I was researching your background. And I think that's an interesting place to start in your story, which is where we always like to start, is like, where does this all begin? So when you first got that diagnosis for your husband, what was it that pushed you into saying, I can be a citizen scientist, I am not going to take this lying down?
Well, I probably have to actually back up to my earlier business training. I actually studied accounting in school, which is a system that has to balance. And I came out of school and went to work for Arthur Andersen as an auditor. And they teach you as an auditor to question everything and examine the evidence for yourself. And they taught me a methodology for how to assess business risk that was called transaction flow review. And so they taught me to draw these flow charts of everything that was going through the business and who touched it and what happened, and to interview firsthand, ask people questions to see where a process might be broken, because that's where the business risk would be. So fast forward from there to 2002, when my husband was diagnosed. So he was 44. We had two small children, and I had an older child from a first marriage. And we go to the doctor, and neurologists are, they're a very serious lot, and they are kind of deadpan in the delivery of what they tell you. And it's kind of like, well, you have a progressive neurological disease, and you know, we have some drugs that can sort of modify your symptoms, but there's sort of a normal course and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. They don't talk to you about a lot of the factors that might be have contributed to it, and they don't, you know, they're not asking questions about your history or any of that. So I came out of it and was really thinking like my transaction flow review is like, how do I look at this picture? What could have contributed to it, and draw the map to try to understand what could be causing it, and then try to unwind that. And so I started actually first with food and looking at the food supply and what we were eating. And in 2002, tried to go all organic, which was very difficult back then because there really wasn't a lot in the way of organic food. But we made a lot of dietary changes, and he did have some pretty significant improvement. But then I started this sort of a concept of drawing your life map. And so every time I would meet a Parkinson's person, I would do an interview. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up on a farm? What kind of jobs did you have? Did you have illnesses as a child? So I just became very inquisitive in terms of trying to understand people's stories and then look for patterns in those stories that might overlap with John to try to understand really what's causing Parkinson's. And along the way, I purchased some market data, and I learned that the number of people under the age of 40 in the last decade had nearly doubled. And this was supposed to be an old person's disease. And so I said to myself, like, this has got to be environmental. So I, you know, widened my lens even further. And then in 2014, I read a book called Missing Microbes by Dr. Martin Blaser. And he's an infectious disease doctor who was studying the effect of antibiotics on the human microbiome and how that had contributed to the rise of all these chronic diseases. And in my interviews with people with Parkinson's, I had learned that many of them had had frequent strep infections as young children and taken a lot of antibiotics. And I had gone to 23andMe, and they had actually looked at their data and seen four or more strep infections had a correlation with an increased risk of Parkinson's. So this antibiotics and the microbiome, that was the first time I had really heard that term, really resonated. And then this, about 4 months later, Dr. Schepperhan's paper came out where he showed that the gut bacteria could divide the two phenotypes of Parkinson's. And I was like, that's it. Quitting what I'm doing, I started funding research at the University of Chicago, where I met one of my co-founders who was really a pioneer in the human microbiome, and my other co-founder, Dr. Suzanne Vernon, who had spent 20 years studying chronic disease at the CDC. And we said, really, there are these commonalities across diseases in the microbiome where we're losing function, and likely a lot of this is environmental. How can we contribute to figuring out what's going on and connecting the dots across these diseases? And so that's when I decided to found the BioCollective to collect stool samples from people across the population and do whole genome sequencing to look at the gut bacteria and see if we could find some patterns.
I gotta say, I don't think many people have such a life-altering diagnosis and moment like that, and then say, okay, I'm going to go start a research company and start sequencing genomes and create the solution to the problem. Like, that's next level, both commitment and passion and love.
Well, it definitely was a labor of love. And I think maybe initially, I didn't realize how big of a commitment it was, because I had had a pretty successful career, and, you know, we had a very nice home and could travel and do anything we wanted. And we pretty much gave all of that up to start the company and took everything we had to try to find the answers. And I think when I first started, I naively thought, wow, that it would be easier than it is to start a company. But now, 9 years later, I'm so happy I did what I did, and I love what I do every day because I feel like I'm helping people and making a difference.
What I heard there was, if I knew what I was getting myself into before I started it, I might not have done it. But how did you walk yourself through those setbacks to get to where you are right now with your company?
Well, to start with, I'm very fortunate to have a family office investor that I have known for many years and I knew from my real estate career. So they have stuck by me. And so that has really helped us because when we started the company and we were collecting stool samples to build a bank to share with scientists across the world, and our concept was, we'll build this bank, scientists in all different areas will do research on the samples and they'll share the data. And so we'll all get to see this big picture. And we did have many people who were interested in the samples, but they did not want to share the data. We're still in a very much collaboration at that grand a scale is just not there yet. You know, people aren't willing to share at that level. So, you know, we sort of inched along for trying to build a market because there was no market for poop, really. And, you know, and I would tell people, well, you know, poop is worth more than an ounce of poop is worth more than an ounce of gold. And they would look at me like I was crazy. And I mean, as it turns out, an ounce of poop is worth more than an ounce of gold, but we were just very, very early to that process. So what we did end up getting, we got an NIH grant and we made a reference material with the NIH grant money because, again, this is an emerging field, the microbiome, and there was no standard reference material. So all the tests that people are running, they don't have a standard to measure their research against or to use as a kind of universal translator. So we did that and built our data as we went, kind of little by little. And then from that data, started to build our own strain bank of probiotic organisms and computational ability to figure out how to put teams together that would work to put back function in the gut. So 2.5 years ago, we took a big pivot and started to make probiotics to focus on improving gut health. And that actually goes back to a Parkinson's meeting that I went to with John. And some researchers there were presenting some data on the sugar alcohol mannitol and that could stop the aggregation of the proteins in Parkinson's in an animal model and pull them out of the brain. And I came back and bought a mannitol chemistry book and started studying it. And one of the early chapters in the book was about probiotic organisms that make mannitol from glucose and fructose. And I got with our chief scientific officer, who's a microbial ecologist with 30 years experience at Cal Poly. And we sat down and basically put together a team of microbes to do a conversion of sugars in the body to make mannitol to help the brain. And we gave it to John and he was walking with a cane at that time and having some difficulty navigating crowds. And within a month, he was no longer walking with a cane and able to navigate a large crowd at our daughter's college graduation. We did microbiome studies and we could see that his microbiome was moving back to a healthier microbiome profile. So then we started sharing that with people. And so that sort of was the seed of the idea to move from this grand scale biobank, which is a pretty huge pivot, to a consumer probiotics company.
That was a significant shift in 1 month. So with what you gave him, was he just taking it once a day? Were you having him take this probiotic several times a day? Like, what did that look like?
He took it twice a day. So he would take it in the morning with his breakfast and in the evening with dinner.
So not even that hard of a protocol.
No, it was not as hard as his Parkinson's medication.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
That's a significant shift, though, to be able to buy back that much function and see
and
that
in under
change.
1 month.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that, I don't know if that, we haven't done a Parkinson's study,
yeah.
But I do get, you know, I do get people, so chronic constipation is an issue with Parkinson's and can precede a diagnosis of Parkinson's by 10 to 15 years. Most people don't really understand what that means. And some people may have suffered from chronic constipation most of their life, so they may think it's normal. But that waste sitting in the body has a lot of toxin production that the body has to deal with. And so the part of the action of the probiotic is to pull fluid into the colon and help have an easier bowel movement. And in our studying of Parkinson's fecal samples, we actually learned the young women in our lab who were collecting the samples could actually tell if someone had Parkinson's just by looking at their stool sample. And it was, it had the consistency of concrete in parts of the sample. And so they had to use different methods to process a Parkinson's stool than they did all the other stools that came in. And I looked all through the academic research and there is nothing on this. And it's just, it's not something that the neurologists typically will even ask that much about. Or if they do, it's...
Yeah. So we work with a lot of people with this neurological type of condition. And I find what you're saying fascinating because I have yet to work with someone with this diagnosis who does not have chronic debilitating constipation. Like if they're not taking something to help them, they're not able to have a normal bowel movement. And like what you already mentioned is that it was present typically either from childhood where they always struggled to have a bowel movement or at least 15 years before the diagnosis, like spot on what you said. And so what I find really fascinating, and I'm glad you brought it up, is when I ask, okay, what did the neurologist tell you to do about this? The answer is usually always, oh, they didn't care, one. And the only reason they're working with me to figure it out is because they are experiencing discomfort and it actually shuts down their quality of life. So they are trying to solve it another way. Or what you just said, they just tell them to take one Metamucil, which will not solve a chronic constipation problem, or just take either Colace or Miralax. And depending on how you dose that or lack of directions for dosing that, it's still not going to solve the chronic constipation problem.
And Miralax actually has some pretty significant impacts on the microbes in your gut. And that's part of the signaling, the metabolites that microbes make in your gut is part of the signaling of peristalsis in the body. So, you know, when you start shifting the microbiome even more and in a more negative direction. One of the really interesting things to me, there are a number of different Parkinson's animal models, but there's about 500 papers that I've found where they use something called an LPS animal model for Parkinson's. And LPS is short for lipopolysaccharide, which is the gram-negative bacteria cell wall. And that's actually used in diabetes disease models, depression disease models, Parkinson's disease models. And I'm sure there are some others, but I've looked at those three. And you can see the higher gram-negative profile of bacteria in the gut bacteria of people with Parkinson's. And they often have leaky gut. So if you think about that constipation sitting in there, they've got a leaky gut. They have the waste sitting there with all of that gram-negative bacteria and lipopolysaccharide that crosses over into the blood. And it's highly inflammatory. So it can go really anywhere in the body, but, you know, ultimately can affect the brain.
It's funny because this conversation is, you know, it's centering currently with the gut is one of the big ways you can observe it is by looking at your poop, which is kind of like a big cross the fingers cultural no-no. Like, we try to pretend we don't have human bodily functions. And so a lot of these people with the chronic constipation, you know, to some degree, as long as it's not too uncomfortable, it's more like it's fine that it's not disrupting their life and they have to deal with going to the bathroom. But for all of us, it's like such an important thing to flip the script and see poop. You just said it's worth more than an ounce of gold, an ounce of great poop, to see it as something that has high value in maintaining the health of our body, and then also has high value in telling us about what's going on inside of our body. And so it's just a fascinating conversation, because no one's going to just be like, hey, I want to talk to you about my poop. Jennifer has to dig it out of people, like drag it out and be like, no, no, this is a safe space. We can actually talk about it. But that's not culturally what it is.
Well, not normally, but my kids call me the poop queen.
I love it.
Because people know what my business is and that, you know, I was very focused on this. I have customers call me and talk to me about their poop. I have, you know, lots of people with Parkinson's who will talk to me about their poop. And so I guess I've made it a little less taboo. Early on in the process, we actually wanted to make a phone app for the Bristol Stool Scale.
Yeah.
And for, you know, your listeners, if they don't know what that is, that's a scale of 1 to 7 where you're looking at your stool. The consistency is from liquid to solid, and you can look at a number of other factors as well. So, but we never had the money to actually make that app. But when I very first was starting the company and I was out on a hike in the mountains in Colorado and I sat down to have lunch, and this couple walked up and sat down and they had a dog with them and they were asking me what I did. And I told them I'm starting this company to collect poop and it can tell you all this great information. And they said, well, you know, that just makes so much sense because we know our dog is sick by looking at his poop.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the color changes, the consistency changes, what you see in it changes. And that's what I coach my clients through too. I was like, how do you know, if you don't look down in the toilet, how do you know something changed if you don't even know when you, quote unquote, you felt like you had a good bowel movement, what that looks like? If you don't know what that looks like, then how do you know when you're not having a good bowel movement if you're not looking down to see the color, to see the consistency, to see how much, to just see, like, take stock. Okay, what does it look like? So that way you can help yourself in the future to know something is getting off or something isn't working well, because you know instantly what your good, healthy bowel movements look like versus, something's changed. So yep. Within that, then, as far as if someone starts your probiotic, and I know you have several different types, but if someone's talking to you and they're saying, hey, I have chronic constipation, and I'm sure you're asking them the questions like, what's your stool look like based on the Bristol stool chart? What do you tell them that they should start looking for if they start taking your probiotic to know what changes it's making in a positive way?
Well, typically what I will hear from the positive direction, and this can be, people can be on either end of the spectrum. They can have issues with diarrhea or issues with constipation, is that they get a much more consistent, regular bowel movement that's kind of right up that middle, a number 3, number 4 Bristol stool score. And, you know, if they thought they were regular before and maybe they went once a day, sometimes they will then go twice a day.
That's great.
I don't think many people also realize that multiple bowel movements a day are actually more ideal, because obviously you want it formed, but then all the things your body's trying to get rid of in that bowel movement are leaving the body very quickly.
Absolutely. You don't want waste sitting around.
Yeah, I do think that this is the grayer part of the conversation, in the sense that, like, if you go see a standard medical professional, like a doctor, they're going to tell you that having a bowel movement just 3 times a week is considered normal. And I do think, because like Western medicine hasn't caught up necessarily with what's a healthy microbiome and what's a healthy transit time for moving stool through the body, because that piece, I don't think updates have happened since that standard of like, well, as long as you're having three bowel movements a week, that's considered healthy. That hasn't changed at all, even with what we are currently discovering and figuring out as far as how integral the microbiome is to health. And so within that, it can get difficult for people to know, okay, this is healthy versus not healthy, because you are getting varying opinions based on the healthcare professional you are currently asking the question to.
Absolutely. And I think the term normal, norms, well, you know, in America, if we said, you know, the norm is X, let's say normal weight. Well, weight in America, we're leading to a large percentage of people on the obese side of the scale. But if you look at it from a percentage basis, then that would be normal. So I think that the use of the term normal as opposed to healthy is kind of a misnomer. And the other thing I would say is I learned a lot about the gut and digestive health from looking at Ayurvedic medicine, because they focus very much on the gut and digestion and looking at your tongue for the appearance of basically toxins in your digestive tract.
Yeah. Those, I think those types of, you know, medicinal practices, they had to rely on things that were visible or describable. And so something like the tongue or something like your stool is going to be a really great source of information about what's going on with the person. And then as you graduated into Western culture, we started relying on other markers and kind of left behind some of the very fundamental basics of like, how is this human doing? I remember the first time I saw a lesson on like, when you're doing a intake on a client or a patient in certain medical settings, you're supposed to lift the skin and see how much collagen is the skin, how stretchy is the skin, how much hair do they have, what is their hydration level when you're lifting the skin, all these different observable things. And culturally, I don't know that we talk about those enough for people to have warning signs go off that this isn't normal, something could be better about this.
Well, and doctors don't examine patients like that anymore. There's rarely a physical exam. And then, you know, in the last 4 years with such a movement to telemedicine, of course, there's, you know, not even any close-up observation.
Yeah, which puts more onus on the person to start to learn and know these things like you did when you got the diagnosis from your husband, because there's this distance that is just currently the way that it is with medicine. And you're the one who has to then pick up the slack of, you know, those observable pieces of information about the human body. And it makes conversations like this very valuable, because just like you became a citizen scientist, started doing the research, started learning, people can start to learn and do their own research and make changes as well. But you have to be able to hear through the noise, because there's a lot of it out there. And that's actually the theme of this season that we're in, is noise versus silence. And with Parkinson's, it feels like one of your first battles is to cut through the noise about what the disease is. And that includes things like just thinking about the brain instead of also looking at the gut. And I think it's a gift to everyone who's getting to use your products that you happen to have a systems brain. And we're like, but let's look at the whole body and not just focus on the brain. Do you remember what some of the noisier messages you heard initially that you had to either like disregard, or that you found research that changed your mind on them, or how did you overcome them?
Well, I think early on in the process, it was just media hype every time you turned around about a new disease-modifying drug.
Yeah.
So it's this disease modification, and that noise. And also, I think for people with Parkinson's, it gives them a kind of a boost of really quick false hope that because oftentimes when something's in the news, it's some kind of new research that wouldn't even be in the market for a decade. And so it's those kind of news hype things about, you know, the latest finding that's going to, but they're always disease modifying. None of it ever says I'm focused on root cause. What's causing this?
Yeah, I think that is the hard part within it is our medical system is very good at helping to modify uncomfortable or even debilitating symptoms. And that's amazing, right? Because then it does allow for quality of life. But what gets often left, you know, behind in this model is, okay, what else can we work on or change with lifestyle and your environment and how you take care of yourself that would modify down to some of the sources of what are driving these symptoms or making them more likely to create this disease state?
Well, it's interesting also to me, just when you're masking symptoms with medications, disease modification, there are often a lot of downstream side effects from the medication that you take to mask that. And so sometimes those actually create noise as being symptoms of Parkinson's when they are really symptoms of the medication. And I use an example. I mean, John only takes the carbidopa levodopa. He has taken some other drugs over the course. And when he had, after he had COVID, he had a pretty severe problem with orthostatic hypotension. And he was taking two other drugs, I think, at the time. But I have a good friend who's a pulmonologist, and he had come to our house several times to help us when John had COVID. And so I was talking to him about the orthostatic hypotension, and that's when you stand up and your blood pressure drops and you can faint. Mm-hmm. And Ed actually looked at John's medications and he said, well, many of the Parkinson's medications cause orthostatic hypotension. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And so one of the ones John was still taking at that time could cause that. And so we tapered him off of it and the blood pressure issues improved.
Mm-hmm. That's a really powerful thing that you're putting a spotlight on, though, that is some of the noise. The medications we so willingly prescribe and take can create their own symptoms in the body, and we're not that culturally kind of in tune to actually saying, yep, this is what's causing it, or did you know this medication can cause it? And what we see is people will still willingly take the medication without looking up what the side effects are. So they aren't even empowered to know what to look for. But then when you say, oh, and I have a probiotic that can help your gut, they're like, where's the science? Show me the study. Like, where's the meta-analysis? And it's a significant, like, close look at something. And I'm like, can you please apply that to the medication you're taking that's giving you six symptoms?
And I think, too, like, symptoms are the body's way of telling us something. And I mean, I'm not a proponent of people with Parkinson's not taking any medications because I know how difficult that can be. Mm-hmm. But I also think it is important to examine what your body is telling you, because there are also emotional roots of disease. You know, I've talked to a number of people about this, and low-grade chronic stress. So there's in Parkinson's, there's kind of a phenotype of hypervigilance, always on the alert in the fight or flight. So it's that hyper alert state and the low grade chronic stress. And I actually, in my observing this and observing other couples with Parkinson's, I found that many people with Parkinson's were married to type A people. Well, of course, you know, somebody who's going to quit their job and go try to save the world and start a new company, that's a type A person. I recognized that in myself after I saw the pattern in other people. And I asked one of our neurologists, I said, do you see that, like, people with Parkinson's are married to, like, really strong personality, type A kind of controlling people? And they said, yes, we do. And so I modified my behavior as a result of that to relieve some of that stress. And, you know, you could ask John, he'll tell you, I'm much different. You know, I still have my moments, but most of the time I'm much, much different than I was 15 years ago before I realized that I was contributing to the stress that was driving some of the symptoms. And people who have Parkinson's, I think, do recognize at least sometimes that stress increases their symptoms, but they may not necessarily be looking at where that stress is coming from. And maybe having an open, honest conversation with their partner if that's part of the source of stress.
And if someone is listening and they know, ooh, yep, I'm the type A person, just like you so awesomely identified yourself and you were willing to say, you know what, I'm the type A potentially in this relationship, which is an amazing thing to be able to do. If someone's listening and going, oh, I know I'm that person in this relationship and my loved one has Parkinson's, what are like one or two tips that you could give them that you found helpful with starting to modify like how you were approaching certain things?
Well, one just kind of simple thing is take a breath and stop before you say something. And don't always try to be in charge or fix everything or do everything or you know, say, do this, do that, do this. Because a lot of Parkinson's people, they're very well behaved. So they follow the rules, they do what you tell them to. And so if you boss them around, they're going to let you boss them around. So I just say, think about whether or not you're bossing them around and don't boss them around. Give them that window to be accountable for themselves and make your, if you want to make reminders or whatever, ask first. Is it okay if I remind you to do this? Or is it okay if I just really think about the other person and not just what's in your head about like what you think should happen?
Those are all really simple yet powerful things to think through. It's interesting because I found even there is a powerful connection between autonomy and the body and the brain and movement and health. And sometimes you do see that when you're getting bossed around or you don't have that full autonomy, there's something that shifts in the ecosystem of the body because we know that our cells listen to our brain. So it would make sense that if some of the things are being pushed from an outside source and not being internally created, it would create a difference in the body.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting too, because he was always an athlete. So he was a runner, ran marathons and cross country in high school and always very athletic. He was a speed skater as a young boy and then a cyclist, and he still does stationary biking. But I think what's interesting about marathoners is they're trained to ignore what their body is telling them, to not listen to the pain, the message, the whatever, to just keep going and power through it. And I wonder if that also doesn't contribute to some sort of a disconnect with the mind and the body.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we don't know exactly what that is, but I, just from my observations of working with like either high athletes or someone who does things like marathons or ultra marathons or what I would call more painful sports as you get farther and farther into them, you do have to disassociate. You have to be able to disconnect from that discomfort. And on some level, then, if the body is telling you that there's something off or there's discomfort going on, I just think it's easier or more natural for someone who knows how to do that well for the achievement of sport to kind of like walk around with, you know, like a broken foot. Like, right, you hear those stories where like, oh yeah, I finally went to the doctor and the pain I was having in my foot, it actually was a fracture. And I just feel like people who have that tendency, those stories more align with, yeah, I was walking around with this broken thing, but I didn't think it was a big deal because that pain to me wasn't nearly as bad as trying to get through mile 22 in a marathon.
Right, exactly.
So I feel like definitely you're bringing a lot more nuance to the conversation of Parkinson's and a lot more nuance to how people can approach treating it. But again, that all stems around you stepping past some of kind of the noisy straight line treatment protocols that are given. So what else you see out there where commonly this is the main message someone is going to get exposed to, but you've seen through what you've researched that there's actually other options, other ways to view it, or the research is changing and the protocols haven't caught up?
Well, I mean, one of the ones that always concerned me, because just the thought of doing it was very stressful for John, but there's a Parkinson's therapy called deep brain stimulation, where they basically drill a hole in your head and put an electrode in there, and you have a battery pack, and there's a frequency that's being a signal that is sent to your brain that stops tremor. And it is typically most beneficial for people who have tremor. And it's done quite frequently, and now they do it in people earlier because they say they have better results that way. I sat in on a medical continuing education on deep brain stimulation that the Cleveland Clinic did. It was probably 4 years ago. And they were talking about advances in DBS and being able to send two-way signals and how much better that was going to be. I mean, it's pretty fascinating technology. But at the same time, they also said, well, you know, it's really only effective for a few years, and then you're kind of back. I mean, it didn't stop the disease progression, and you're back taking as many drugs as you were before and more. And so it's kind of a stopgap measure. And I think there's a couple of things with that. One, I have seen people where it has made a remarkable difference. So I'm not saying not to do that, but what I'm saying is to be very thorough in your examination of that, if it is a good fit for your symptom profile, because it can often make voice things worse. It can make gait worse. So different doctors are trained or have done more of those surgeries. So we had several friends who had trouble with DBS surgeries. So, you know, I think it's one of those things where if you have a doctor and they suggest it to you, you know, people don't want to go shopping around. But I think if somebody's going to drill a hole in your head, I would say go shop around, make sure you talk to people who have used that surgeon and, you know, look at their track record and understand very clearly if it's the best solution for your particular symptom profile. So I think that's a very noisy area. And there's also a lot of general noise around electronic solutions for Parkinson's and sort of turning Parkinson's people into cyborgs with different electronic things. But there are some interesting technologies on the horizon. There's, I think it's magnetic, some kind of magnetic treatment which is interesting to me because there is lots of evidence in the clinical research of iron overload in the brain. And they're basically using some sort of magnetic treatment. I can't think of the exact name of it right now. The doctor who's doing it, its name is Rezai. And they've had some pretty remarkable, I just saw a short video of someone who went in who had a terrible, terrible tremor and did the treatment. I don't think it took maybe an hour. I I can't remember the exact length of time, and completely the tremor was gone.
Mm. And so do you, to be clear, like what I'm hearing is they're using the magnets to help with the iron overload that's in the brain?
Well, they're not saying that. I just, when I saw the story, I was like, well, this makes sense to me because, you know, if there's iron overload in the brain, perhaps the magnet is somehow allowing that to
be pull it. Yeah.
Or reconfigure or move to a new area. Or so it was interesting to me from that perspective.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because part of what, what I help people do is to look at a wider lens of how you can help support your body with Parkinson's. And I have read all of the research on the iron overload in the brain. And I highly recommend that people get, you know, full panels of their iron and then all of the extra nutrients that are involved with how iron is used in the body. So including magnesium, copper, zinc, and seeing how well is the body keeping these minerals in balance to each other and how they should be. And I definitely see a lot of imbalances within the mineral category when you do have neurological stuff going on. And I find it interesting because many times, because of what happens with taking the L-DOPA, from my perspective nutritionally, some people can get into trouble with their food and eating enough and getting into underweight status and even sarcopenia status with their muscle because they're very scared to eat and they're trying to keep the timing of the medication right. And then your hunger cues get affected. And so then they start to get into this underfed state. And so then you get into this kind of like quagmire, or what came first, the chicken or the egg, because then you also start to get, you know, these deficiencies happening because they're not eating enough because they're taking the medication many, many times during the day. And then that's also affecting their appetite. And so from my perspective, I'm always trying to help people see the bigger picture of saying, okay, let's take a step back and see your body as a whole and realize that you need food first to keep that energy going and your body thriving. But then on top of it, we want to see, is your body absorbing these good things that you are giving it? And so all of that to say, what I see is when we're talking about the noise and how we can help people live better with chronic diseases, it's nutrition and actually getting these blood tests that actually show you on, you know, paper, you know, a snapshot. It's not perfect, but a snapshot of where is your body? Like, how are you utilizing your B vitamins versus how are you utilizing your minerals? I have found from my perspective that it really helps to improve quality of life because a lot of people get into inadvertent nutritional deficient states just because it is a lot to manage. And so within that, my question would be, is that kind of what you kind of see with working with this population yourself, where it does get a little overwhelming to know how to look bigger picture because you are just trying to manage the day-to-day on some level?
Well, I do hear that from quite a few people, particularly where they won't eat because protein interferes with the medication, so they won't, so they're not getting enough protein. But the minerals imbalance is it's an area of keen interest of mine, going all the way back to looking at what we were doing to the food supply. And kind of my pet peeve is with the amount of glyphosate that is used in food. And that's an organophosphate. If you look at organophosphate poisoning and the symptoms of that, you know, you could chalk off the list of Parkinson's symptoms, organophosphate insecticides and herbicides. Glyphosate is the main herbicide that most people have heard of. And it is a minerals chelator. So it binds all of those minerals. It binds them in the soil so the plant can't access them. It binds them in, it binds them in our bodies. So trying to avoid as much as possible those organophosphates is pretty critical, but it's become increasingly difficult to do because now there's about 60 crops that use glyphosate at the end of harvest to dry the crop. And I actually think that may be one of the issues that so many people are having with grains and breads, because they're actually dried down at the end of harvest with glyphosate. And then about 50% of the gut bacteria are susceptible to glyphosate. And so glyphosate is killing the good gut bacteria, leaving behind the bad gut bacteria. And you're ending up unable to, so your gut bacteria produce your B vitamins with those minerals, and lots of enzymes require a metal a trace mineral cofactor to function. So you don't get all those enzymes working, and you can't get your aromatic amino acids. So phenylalanine, tryptophan, and tyrosine, and all of those are really critical in a disease, in the neurotransmitters, and in a disease like Parkinson's. So, and I can't remember if I said this, but the Central Valley of California, where about 50% of America's produce is grown, is called Parkinson's Alley. So that should tell us something about what we're doing environmentally to that area, and then overall to our food that is contributing to this problem, and then the minerals deficiency in everybody, but presenting in different ways, and in Parkinson's, certainly as the neurological symptoms.
We live outside the Central Valley. Like, we're not that close to it, but close enough to kind of be aware of some of the agricultural problems that are there. And we really like to keep things simple for people. And so, honestly, I don't like to overemphasize toxins in food and organic and things like that, but you can't actually get away from it. And if you have a body that isn't particularly good at handling those toxins, then you're going to have problems with the metabolization and the impact that that has in the body. And because we've had such radical changes to our food supply, I think that's why we're seeing such a radical rise in neurological diseases, including Parkinson's. I had seen a study that came out that, and it was before the pandemic, which is ironic, the pandemic's 2020, but in 2018, the study actually called Parkinson's a pandemic because the rate of increase was just off the chart. And I do think it has to do with food and how ubiquitous that is to all of us and all of our brains.
It is, but the good news, on the other hand, is that there are some bacteria that can actually break these things down and help us eliminate them. And so
we're smiling over here.
That is great news.
That is great news.
Which bacteria are these specifically?
So a couple of things. We actually found Lactobacillus plantarum that was resistant to glyphosate and could break it down and not produce something called AMPA that is more toxic. So a lot of bacteria can break it down, but they'll produce AMPA, which is excitotoxic to the brain. But so all of our probiotics contain our Lactobacillus plantarum that does that. But there are also a lot of the spore-forming bacteria. So you see, like, Megaspore is mm-hmm. one of the, and that's been a practitioner line that's been around for a long time. I think that has four different spore-forming bacteria, and a lot of those are very good at breaking down organophosphates or toxins. Also, the Acetobacter that is in apple cider vinegar is a strain that will typically have the genes that can break down glyphosate. And sauerkraut juice. We actually have done some research with Dr. Don Huber, who's kind of one of the global experts on glyphosate. And sauerkraut juice has a number of spore-forming and lactobacillus that can break down glyphosate.
What I heard was buy the sauerkraut.
Well, that is interesting because typically, though, you're also using apple cider vinegar when you are eating a salad sometimes, like to make your salad dressing. And, you know, greens and leafy greens are going to be more of a place where you can get exposed to more pesticides. And so it's, in a way, it's helping to neutralize that.
Yes. I mean, because you do have to eat, and it's like you don't want to make people so afraid of eating that they won't eat anything. You know, you got to eat.
That's the noise.
Yeah.
Because you got to eat.
It's a balance. Yeah.
We have people who, once they learned about, you know, pesticides in fruits and vegetables, then they reduced their intake of fruits and vegetables because they couldn't justify the organic prices. And I think that's a tricky space where then you're losing all of the benefits that come along with the fruits and vegetables. And so there's got to be a kind way to have that conversation where you raise awareness and you get people to make choices where you can and they can without creating fear. That said, your company is also helping improve the odds by, right? I'm assuming you have to have something that includes these different
strains. You said all of your blends can include the lactobacillus.
All of our blends contain the lactobacillus, and I think all of the blends also contain we have a spore former Bacillus subtilis, and it has many of those capabilities as well.
And so with spore former, like how many different strains of that type is in the bottle that you sell?
So I only have one spore former bacteria. So if you look, I think Megaspore is four different ones. We do have another one that we're looking to bring to market, not so much for detoxification, but for help with muscle mass.
Oh.
But that'll probably be toward the end of next year.
You're going to have to keep us posted on that, because one of our big passions is muscle and avoiding sarcopenia and helping people protect their muscle.
Well, that was one of the things. So John did remarkably well after going on our probiotic. His UPDR score improved. It went from a 35 down to a 20. So the lower the score, the better off you are. And it stayed at a 20 for about 4 years. And then he had COVID at the end of 2021. And he had a pretty severe setback. And we've spent a lot of time, you know, the last 2 years really getting him back from that COVID setback. And part of that was he lost about, I want to say, probably close to 15 pounds with the COVID. And he had 6 months of kind of lingering COVID symptoms and no energy. And so he really got off his exercise routine. And so getting his muscle mass back and strength has been one of the toughest things, because once you lose it, it's much harder to get back.
Yes. That understanding that distinction of, like, you want to do everything possible to preserve this versus lose it. But like what you said, he fell into an unavoidable circumstance where he was just trying to beat COVID first, and it led to this, you know, unwanted outcome, but it also sounds like he's doing the work to try and gain that back.
Yes, and it's interesting because we've incorporated more nutritionist help, I guess, along the way. He's been doing a lipid replacement therapy where he eats every 2 hours, and that has actually helped him put some weight back on.
That's good, because, so what that tells me is, right, he's a high energy burner. So you're trying to keep the inputs coming in as often as possible so that eventually you gain the positive output, which is weight gain, from that.
Right. And we stop the sort of bonking of no energy. There's definitely, lately I've been looking at glucose metabolism, and, you know, there is some indication in both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's that they call it type 3 diabetes, that it's insulin resistance of the brain, that somehow, you know, the glucose is just not getting to the brain. And so then what happens is you're making alternate fuel sources, lactate, which can help the brain, but he gets lactate buildup, and he recognizes that as a former runner, he'll get a kind of a wild-eyed look and his legs will freeze. And, you know, I just asked him, what does it feel like when that happens? And he said, it feels like lactic acid. And so that sent me looking at, you know, these metabolic pathways. And there's so many. I mean, the human body is so amazing. It has all these different backups, like, okay, if this doesn't work, try this. If this doesn't work, try that. You know, burn fat, do this. But you have somebody like John who is very thin and has no fat, so he can't, you know, his gluconeogenesis doesn't work. So, mm-hmm. you know, what his options are narrowed and narrowed and narrowed to, you know, making lactate if he can't get glucose to his brain. So when you start to understand all these different biochemical pathways, which I don't expect most people to do,
right.
you know, you start to think about, okay, how could we... You know, how can we put food back into this equation in a way that can retrain the body to be more metabolically flexible to do some of these other things?
Yes, the metabolic flexibility, but just metabolic health in general is really keying for just managing any disease and making sure that you're checking in on all those different ways the metabolism is going to adapt or change depending on the inputs coming in. It really can be a game changer. So a question, I'm just very curious, like, has he done a continuous glucose monitor?
He has not done a continuous glucose monitor. And I think that actually would be beneficial. He does have a Keto Mojo and...
Uh-huh.
and he was doing that for a while, I would say he probably did that for 6 months or so during the long COVID period, because I should probably go back and look at this again. I had a thought that maybe he had something called diabetes insipidus. And now yep. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly why I thought that,
mm-hmm.
but it might be worth going back and looking at again. But
yeah, even from the angle of, because you're noticing that he's benefiting from eating every 2 hours.
Yes.
So my first thought with that is that he might be someone who is hypoglycemic. So he gets low blood sugar often. And this can be due to many different things, including low muscle, etc. But if what I find is within the blood sugar conversation, most people are constantly focused on high blood sugars. But what I find within the chronic illness spectrum is that, yes, you get high blood sugars sometimes, but the high blood sugars are being driven by a propensity to go into hypoglycemia. So low blood sugar, way too low. And figuring out if your body is doing that, where you're chronically skipping into low blood sugar, even with eating, I see this commonly, then your blood sugar is going to spike. You're going to get really high levels after that because, right, the body's smart. It's going to try and fix that low blood sugar problem because it's not good for the brain, especially. And so you're going to get then the opposite effect. And then you're on this roller coaster all day of the highs and the lows and the highs and the lows.
Well, what's interesting about that is also I have noticed that many, many people with Parkinson's are sugar addicts. And uh-huh. so, you know, maybe that has evolved for them because maybe there is this underlying dysregulation and hypoglycemia and, you know, eating a bite of sugar is that sort of quick fix to make the brain feel better.
Yes. From my experience, if someone is looking at me and telling me, I feel better when I eat sugar, you know, and they're usually using, you know, negative language after that of like, oh, I know it's so bad for me. But even if they like, say, eat an apple versus grabbing like a jelly bean, when you're in this category, you absolutely notice the difference between an apple and a jelly bean. Because when you're in that hypoglycemic state, you need fast recovered energy. Like you need to get that blood sugar up quickly and it's going to go up quick. Slower with choosing something like fruit, just even if you're eating fruit by itself. And so then they get into this category of thinking, oh, I'm a sugar addict, or, oh, I can't quit eating sugar. And it's actually them being really smart technically, because if they didn't have this tendency, then they could be passing out.
Yeah, that I think There actually may be something to that on a larger scale with Parkinson's, and I don't know if anyone is looking at that.
It would be a fascinating thing to explore for sure. I do think the CGMs, because I saw this week they had made an announcement that a company was making them available mass market, no longer just through a prescriber. And you know, it's a complex conversation on some people can still use a CGM to create neuroses around health and food. And it's not helpful if you don't know how to interpret the data and understand that blood sugar rises and falls as a natural healthy human. But that said, for a lot of people, the symptoms they're attributing because of the noise about how we talk about food and like glucose and sugar and everything, they're thinking high blood sugar all the time, and not a lot of people are understanding low blood sugar. And when you stick a CGM on, it provides that movie of clarity where you're getting to see all the rolling highs and lows. And for a lot of people, I think it's not even something where you commit to wearing it for a long time. The first time I put one on, I was like, OMG. It's not high blood sugar. It's low blood sugar that makes me feel terrible. And just understanding that flipped how I was fueling myself and my fuel sources and changed everything. And I know a lot of people who were surprised that they were actually on the low side, especially like people who've been awake in the middle of the night. And then you realize they'd gone down into the 50s and their body was like, we need some emergency help here. And then they're actually waking up off of the cortisol rise of their blood sugar.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I'm in a group with some keto people who are, might want to look at that, I would say.
Yes, that. So key, like being awake and that, because with keto, what happens is, right, you store glycogen in the liver. That's your backup sugar, glucose resource, right? And that's right. When even like your husband being a marathon, right? That's when you hit the wall, is if that liver source runs out, your body will literally physically stop moving because there's no more energy left in the body, right? And with keto, because if you're not doing refeeds or infusing carbohydrates strategically into the diet, then that glycogen storage is going to keep getting lower and lower in your liver. And that is what keeps you asleep at night. So if someone is someone who has hypoglycemic tendencies or just has insulin resistance or poor blood sugar control, if that is lacking, your sleep is going to be greatly affected.
Very interesting. Well, I'll have to keep that in mind when I talk to people.
Yes, because even, especially if they're in really low levels or dire straits, or they're in chronic, I'm not sleeping at all states, doing a nighttime snack then starts to buffer that, because it takes a little bit to build the glycogen back up in the liver.
Right.
And so then you need to be giving them food to be using instead.
Like strategically, where it's like the right amount for their body, where it's going to get utilized and then keep everything stable for a shot at a good night's sleep, which we know is obviously extremely important for health and healing too. So this is exactly why you have to take a systems approach to your health, and why I love that you do that, because everything's all tied together and systematically everything affects the body, including how you're eating and how you're sleeping.
And I mean, so I'm definitely going to take this to John, because we're going to have to start observing like when the last time he ate before he went to bed or something, because some nights he sleeps really great and then other nights he'll be up 3, 4, 5 times. And I wonder if it might be blood sugar.
Yes, I would highly recommend looking at that. And then the other tip that I would give you is at the dinner that you eat, look to see if it's a dinner that's more of a salty dinner, is the easiest way I would explain it. Like, or if it didn't have as much salt, or you didn't even add salt to it, because depending on what's going on with mineral balance, your sodium and potassium are also going to play into that cortisol rhythm, keeping your blood sugar regulated. That's also a key piece. So saltier meals will also, especially if you're someone who tends to be low salt, low potassium, you're going to sleep better because you infused yourself with that salt, and it's going to keep your blood sugar regulated and your heart rate better, depending on where you're falling on that mineral spectrum.
That's so interesting, because I bought a bag of Celtic sea salt, and he just naturally likes to take a pinch of it and put it in his mouth. And I think that's his own telling him, you know, you need a little salt.
Yes. I would absolutely tell you that's a yes. And it's highly likely if you look at, if he's done recent lab work, you could see what his salt and potassium levels are. And even what commonly gets missed is even the ratio of potassium to salt to each other and if they're imbalanced or not.
I think we just did look at that. I'll have to go back and look at the notes of what that was because she ordered some more blood work for him.
Good.
That's great. Yeah. You can actually look.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, because that can be a big difference with being able to sleep as well.
So I want to...
I learned something new. I'm so excited.
We're all learning. I love it. And it's, again, thinking about systems approach in the body. And also with, I mean, the whole reason we're here talking with you today is because you refuse to just hear the noisy message that Parkinson's is just a one-track train and you can't get off of it and you're racing to the end and that's it. And instead you said, no, let's actually learn things, look at the body as a system and figure out how we can support the body. And you've created something that now helps so many people because of what you're creating. And so I want to wrap up this with just a question to you about any final suggestion you have to people on how they overcome the noise. Because if you are someone with this diagnosis or you have a loved one with this diagnosis, that's a noisy moment where the voices surrounding you can be pretty overwhelming. Do you have any common advice you give people to just help cut through the noise, take a step back, and then approach Parkinson's differently?
Well, you know, my best advice is to not turn on every Parkinson's alert you can have on your phone and to really take a step back and reconnect with your body and listen to what your body is telling you. And that's the best way to cut out noise, I think, from my perspective. I'm not saying you don't want to kind of keep abreast of what's going on in the Parkinson's world, but you also don't want to be, you know, popping at every piece of news noise about Parkinson's, because as Parkinson's continues, the number of people with Parkinson's continues to grow, the sound bites about Parkinson's in the news will continue to grow, the noise will continue to grow.
I think that's really great advice. It's kind of the same for any disease state in that you have to be selective to not overwhelm the brain with information and allow yourself to get a clear path forward. But then with something like Parkinson's, where there's a lot of research coming out and there are for-profit medicines and different things, it's just easy to get swept up and distracted. And so silencing the noise a little bit can make it a lot easier to just take the next best step forward. Thank you for joining us today as we dove really deep into the fascinating world of gut health and its profound impact on our well-being, especially in the context of Parkinson's disease and overall brain health. Martha's amazing in her journey from being a business turnaround expert to a microbiome researcher and a gut turnaround expert is not just inspiring, but also is very enlightening for both Jennifer and I, and we hope it gave you a lot of new ideas and things to think about as well. The amazing thing is this is part one of a two-part series, and I'm not overpromising when I say that part two is even better. Martha talks to us all about yellow soup. And I have to tell you, it's the most horrifying and amazing thing I've heard anyone mention in a while. And it's a great conversation that dives really deep just into the overall general impact of the microbiome. Now, you could tell from this conversation, and we'll dig into it even more in part two, Martha and her team are fanatical about understanding the microbiome and developing good things that start to help change the systems of the body. Jennifer and I love their products. We personally use them, and we also recommend them as well. And Martha has given us a coupon code that you can use to try the probiotics. It's She Changes in all capital letters to get 10% off your order. You can just visit the link that is in the podcast description. So, consider checking out the probiotics and mark your calendars for next week when we're back with part two of this captivating series. And thank you for listening.